Before the colonizers came with chains and flags, there were cities beneath the sea, temples that whispered to the stars, drums that could raise the dead. In the caves, the ancestors wait. In the soil, the bones still sing. And in the people, the memory lives. This is not myth. This is not fantasy. This is the true story of the Caribbean the world tried to erase. Lost Civilizations of the Caribbean Uncovered, a living documentary series, a voice for the voiceless, a call to remember who we were before they told us who to be. If you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Whispers Beneath the Waves. The Caribbean is known today for turquoise beaches, rum-soaked rhythms, and colonial legacies. But long before Columbus, long before the words discovery and conquest were etched into textbooks, there were empires here. Not imagined, not primitive, but real, breathing civilizations, now barely remembered. And some say their bones still whisper beneath the waves. Our journey begins not with maps, but with silence, the kind that hides in wind passing through jungle ruins, or in waves that crash over sunken cities no textbook has dared to name. The colonial records speak of savages, of natives, of first contact. But they do not speak of memory, and memory is where we begin. Long before Europeans arrived, the Caribbean was home to thriving, organized societies. Most famously, the Taino, the people of the good, stretched across Cuba, Hispaniola, Puerto Rico, and parts of the Bahamas. But even the Taino were not the beginning. Beneath their lineage lie older, stranger civilizations, largely unspoken, sometimes unnamed. Civilizations whose only legacy now lies in fragments. Shattered pottery, mysterious petroglyphs carved into cave walls, bone tools buried beneath volcanic ash. What happened to these people? Where did they go? And why were they erased so thoroughly? In the deep jungle heart of Dominica, there's a riverbed that runs dry during certain seasons. Locals tell stories of a buried village, one that surfaces only when the land is thirsty. Under layers of silt and tangled roots, broken ceremonial masks lie half buried in the earth. Their features are not Taino. They're older, angular, alien. There are no surviving names for the people who wore them. Oral histories across the Caribbean refer to the ones who came before. The Zimis, the spirits the Taino worshipped, were believed to have once been walking ancestors, flesh and blood, who turned into guardians over time. Carvings found in Puerto Rican caves depict beings with large round eyes, short limbs, and elaborate headdresses. Some researchers speculate they're deities. Others believe they're renderings of a lost people. But here's where the mystery deepens, and history begins to twist. When the Spanish arrived, they didn't just kill. They rewrote. Temples were torn down, their stones used to build fortresses. Ceremonial drums were silenced, replaced by church bells. Whole histories, passed mouth to mouth for centuries, were snuffed out in the time it takes to light a torch. They called it conversion. The ancestors called it erasure. In Haiti's mountainous north, an old maroon woman once guided an anthropologist to a cave her grandmother had forbidden her from entering as a child. Inside, charcoal drawings told the story of a journey across water. Not by canoe, but by what appeared to be great floating temples. The figures drawn in black and red ink wore armor made of shell and bone. Their eyes were painted blue. These drawings predate the Spanish. They are unlike any Taino art. They speak of a people who came, stayed, vanished, and perhaps never wanted to be found again. Were these merchants? Migrants from Central or South America? Or were they something else? A forgotten Caribbean civilization swallowed by volcanic eruptions, hurricanes, or myth itself? We don't know. But the land remembers. The Caribbean isn't just a region. It's a crossroads. And long before ships arrived from Europe, waves brought people from Africa, from the Orinoco Basin, from Mesoamerica, all long before the so-called Age of Discovery. Archaeological finds in Guadeloupe have uncovered tools that resemble those used by the Nok civilization of West Africa. In Barbados, stone structures sit hidden under sugar plantations, structures that suggest celestial alignments, similar to Mayan astronomy. On the southern tip of St. Lucia, villagers speak of those who lived among the wind, who vanished after a great quake and were never seen again. Each island holds a riddle. Each shoreline, a broken syllable from a language no longer spoken. Colonial powers were terrified of legacy. Legacy meant identity. Identity meant resistance. And so they buried what came before. But they couldn't bury everything. In St. Vincent, deep in the interior, there exists a sacred tree known only to elders. Beneath its roots lie stones arranged in circular formations. No European pattern, no Christian explanation. Offerings still appear there. Feathers, bits of cloth, drops of rum. It is a grave. It is a memory. It is a remnant. And remnants tell the truth when records lie. But perhaps the most haunting proof of a lost civilization lies not on land, but under the sea. Near Cuba's western tip, sonar scans in the early 2000s revealed what appeared to be massive stone structures 700 meters beneath the surface. Perfectly shaped, squared, aligned, too perfect for nature. Theories emerged: Atlantean cities, ancient mariner outposts, even extraterrestrial relics. But most archaeologists dismissed the find, calling it fantasy. Still, the Caribbean Sea doesn't need to shout. It waits, and it knows. What we are left with today is fragmentation. Scattered relics of cultures who once danced under different stars, governed by their own rhythms, buried now beneath centuries of colonial noise. Yet the bones remain. The carvings remain. The whispered names, Yaya, Itabakawaba, Jurikan, refuse to disappear. This chapter is only the beginning of relearning what was lost, the beginning of listening to the waves, the rocks, the stories in the caves. Because history isn't just what's written, it's what refuses to stay buried. And in the Caribbean, the earth still speaks. The Taino, beneath the smoke of a vanished world. If you listen closely in the forests of Boracan, the land we now call Puerto Rico, you might still hear them. Not voices, not echoes, but the memory of movement. A whisper of feet on soil, the hush of a canoe gliding through mangrove roots, the slow rhythm of a drum beaten for the gods. The Taino were not the beginning, but they were the last breath before the storm. The final chapter of indigenous sovereignty before the Caribbean was swallowed by European flags and foreign tongues. They called themselves the Nataino, the noble ones. Not savages, not primitives, but caretakers of islands gifted by their ancestors. Their world was lush, balanced, and sacred, a world designed not for conquest, but for coexistence. And then came the ships. When Columbus arrived in 1492, it was the Taino who greeted him. With open hands. With food. With peace. It would be the greatest mistake in Caribbean history. At the time, the Taino civilization stretched across Cuba, Hispaniola, Jamaica, Puerto Rico, the Bahamas, and beyond, part of the larger Arawakan-speaking world that connected the Antilles to South America's northern river basins. Their trade networks were vast. Their knowledge of the stars precise. Their society, matrilineal and spiritually rich, revered balance and memory. Taino chiefs, known as caciques, ruled alongside spiritual leaders called bohiques, who were healers, astronomers, and keepers of history. They governed through consensus, not fear. Each village was a circle, literally and symbolically. Even their ceremonial plazas, used for sacred ball games and ancestral rites, were shaped like the solar path. They believed in Yukahu, the god of cassava and life, and Atabe, the mother of water and fertility. To them, everything was a spirit. A stone. A tree. A bird. Nothing was just material. Everything breathed. But the Europeans saw none of that. They didn't see gods. They saw gold. And obedience. And targets. Within decades of Columbus' landfall, the Taino were subjected to brutality so severe, it bordered on genocide. Spanish swords weren't their only killers. Disease, carried by rats and sailors, swept through villages like silent hurricanes. Smallpox. Measles. Typhus. Invisible plagues to which they had no immunity. Entire islands fell quiet. Entire bloodlines disappeared. Colonial reports claimed the Taino were extinct by the mid-1500s. But those reports were lies. The Taino didn't vanish. They hid. They intermarried. They adapted. And above all, they remembered. In the mountains of eastern Cuba, in the highlands of Puerto Rico, and along the remote rivers of the Dominican interior, families carried rituals forward in whispers. Bohiques became curanderos. Ceremonial dances became folk customs. Petroglyphs became forbidden sites visited only under moonlight. The sacred never died. It simply wore a disguise. And in recent decades, their descendants have stepped forward. Modern genetic studies show that over 60% of people in Puerto Rico today carry indigenous Taino ancestry through their maternal line. The bloodline never broke. Only the story did. The symbols remain, carved into caves like the Cueva del Indio in Puerto Rico, where spirals, faces, and solar glyphs still mark the walls. In the Dominican Republic, underwater artifacts retrieved from Lake Enriquillo speak of Taino rituals tied to the lunar calendar. Across the Caribbean, sacred sites are still being discovered, some built on top of older, pre-Taino foundations. What does that tell us? That the Taino were not alone. That before them, others stood in the same places, under the same stars, carving the same spirals into stone. A continuum, a story deeper than names. But perhaps the most powerful rediscovery is language. For centuries, Taino words were erased, mispronounced, or co-opted into colonial vocabulary. But they remain. Barbecue, hurricane, hammock, canoe, tobacco. Every time these words are spoken, the Taino speak again. Even the names of the islands themselves are echoes. Jamaica, from Zamaca, land of wood and water. Haiti, from Ayatai, land of high mountains. Cuba, possibly from Cubanican, meaning central place. They named the land not for conquest, but for connection, for essence, for spirit. Today, across the Caribbean diaspora, there is a Taino Renaissance. People once told to forget are now reclaiming their heritage. Ceremonies are being revived. Languages studied. Bones once boxed in colonial museums are returning home to soil. And the silence is breaking. The Taino are not extinct. They were never gone. They were buried beneath smoke, shadow, and shame, and now they rise. The Kalinago, warriors in the path of fire. They were called Caribs by the Spanish. Cannibals in European records. But to themselves, they were Kalinago, the island people, the children of stone and sea, forged in resistance and sharpened by generations of survival. Where the Taino were seen as peaceful and diplomatic, the Kalinago were feared, warriors of the Lesser Antilles who would not bow, not trade peace for chains, not offer fruit to ships bearing crosses and gunpowder. But were they truly as savage as painted? Or were they simply the last flame of Caribbean freedom, burning in a world that wanted only silence? To understand the Kalinago, you must travel east, to the arc of islands known as the Windward Chain, Dominica, St. Vincent, Grenada, Martinique, and the smaller lands that lie like broken teeth in the sea. These were not wide, gentle isles like Cuba or Hispaniola. These islands were volcanic, wild, carved by storms, and so were the people. The Kalinago were mariners, hunters, warriors, and protectors. Oral traditions say they arrived after pushing north from the South American mainland, riding the Orinoco River like a lifeline, sailing by dugout canoe into the unknown, settling only where the rocks spoke their name. By the time Europeans arrived, the Kalinago were deeply rooted in the Lesser Antilles and fiercely determined to stay. The Kalinago fought back. From the very first landings, they ambushed, outmaneuvered, and resisted colonial incursions. In Dominica, they used the rainforest like a blade, vanishing into mist, only to reappear behind enemy lines. In St. Vincent, they built alliances with escaped African slaves, forging what would become the Garifuna people, a fusion of Kalinago strength and African defiance. To the Spanish, they were a nightmare. To the French and English, an obstacle. And to the Caribbean, they were legend. But legend is a double-edged sword. European chroniclers, desperate to justify the brutality of conquest, began painting the Kalinago as monsters. They said they ate human flesh, stole women, worshipped demons. They used the term Carib as shorthand for other, unholy subhuman. This wasn't accidental. The doctrine of discovery, backed by the Pope, gave colonizers divine permission to enslave savages. And so, labeling the Kalinago as cannibals wasn't a report, it was a strategy. But when you dig into the actual records, the ones uncolored by conquest, the truth looks different. The Kalinago had a complex society, ruled by chiefs and guided by spiritual leaders. They practiced agriculture, fishing, and medicine. Their homes were circular, their villages centered around communal spaces. Their religion was animist, like the Taino, and they believed in spirit beings who lived in rivers, rocks, and trees. Their weapons were not just for war, but for protection, forged out of a need to survive in a world that never gave them rest. Were they aggressive? Yes, when their survival depended on it. Were they cannibals? The evidence is murky, at best. Some say they ritually consumed small pieces of flesh from defeated enemies, not for sustenance, but for spiritual power. Others argue this was mythology weaponized by invaders. What is clear is this: the Kalinago refused to kneel. Their greatest stronghold was Dominica, an island so dense, so rugged, that neither France nor Britain could fully claim it. Throughout the 1600s and 1700s, the Kalinago waged a centuries-long guerrilla war, striking colonial settlements, freeing slaves, and vanishing into the mist before muskets could fire. In St. Vincent, the Kalinago fought alongside the newly formed Garifuna in the First and Second Carib Wars, repelling British forces again and again, until betrayal and disease tipped the balance. The final blow came in 1797, when the British deported over 5,000 Garifuna and Kalinago to the coast of Central America. Exiled by sea, their land stolen, their memory fractured. But the spirit never drowned. Today, on the windward coast of Dominica, there is a place called the Kalinago Territory, a legally recognized district, home to over 3,000 descendants who still bear the names, the stories, and the fire of those who fought. Here, children grow up learning the Kalinago language, weaving traditional baskets, performing rituals to hurricanes as spirits, and planting cassava just as their ancestors did. Tourists come to watch. But for the people who live here, it's not a reenactment. It's resistance in motion. In the museums of Paris and London, Kalinago skulls sit behind glass, labeled savage, displayed without ceremony. But in the soil of the Caribbean, in the hands of a young girl in Dominica braiding her grandmother's hair, the real story lives on. They tried to erase the Kalinago by mythologizing them into monsters. But monsters don't have memories, and the Kalinago remember everything. The Atlantis of the Caribbean, fact or colonial fiction. It began not with a discovery, but with a signal. A sharp, strange reflection from beneath the sea off Cuba's western coast. Sonar imaging. Something massive. Something unnatural. It was the early 2000s. A team of oceanographers working with Canadian engineer Paulina Zelitsky had been mapping the deep waters near the Yucatan Channel, a dark trench where the Caribbean Sea swells and plunges. What they found defied belief, or at least it should have. Because buried beneath 700 meters of water, they detected what appeared to be an ancient city, symmetrical stone structures, broad avenues, pyramidal shapes, all laid out with the precision of architectural design. The press called it the Atlantis of the Caribbean. But is it real? Or just another illusion, shaped by myth, colonial imagination, and the hunger to believe in what we've already lost? To understand the weight of this discovery, you must first understand how rare it is for man-made structures to sit that deep, nearly half a mile underwater. Human cities don't sink that far unless they are swallowed by catastrophic geological events, the kind that rewrite coastlines and erase civilizations without a trace. What Zelitsky's team claimed to find, and what some independent analysts tentatively confirmed, looked like monolithic stone blocks, pyramidal features, and rectilinear formations resting on the ocean floor. No natural formation could explain the order. And yet, the scientific community recoiled. There was no rush to verify it. No global expedition. Just silence. Skepticism. Shrugged shoulders. Why? Because the implications were too big. If the structures were real, they weren't built by any known Caribbean civilization. At least, not one documented by European records. They would predate the Taino, the Kalinago, and even the Arawakan migrations. They would suggest a civilization lost so completely that even its language, name, and gods have vanished, leaving only stone shadows in the dark. But the Caribbean is no stranger to mysteries. Across the region, oral traditions speak of islands that no longer exist, vanished lands, swallowed by the sea, remembered only in story. In Jamaican Maroon folklore, there is talk of a stone kingdom beneath the waves, where ancestors rest until the sea gives them permission to rise again. Among the Garifuna of Central America, songs speak of deep homes, cities drowned but not defeated. And in Cuban Yoruba spiritualism, the ocean is not just water, it's a veil, a memory keeper. Were these stories just metaphor? Or were they remnants of something older, something real? The colonial machine never wanted to believe in advanced Caribbean civilizations. Why? Because if the Caribbean had Atlantis of its own real, complex, powerful societies that predated conquest, it would shatter the entire narrative of European supremacy. It would turn the colonizers into destroyers of greatness, not bringers of progress. And so, whenever such discoveries emerge, they are met with the same tactics. Minimize. Discredit. Delay. No major governments funded an expedition to the site. Zelitsky herself was eventually sidelined. The data sat in archives, labeled unverified, ambiguous, G geological anomalies. But anomalies don't form pyramids. Nature doesn't build boulevards. Even if the structures turn out not to be man-made, the desire to suppress the story tells us something. It tells us the world isn't ready to confront the full scope of Caribbean history, a history that may include not just resistance, but civilizational memory, long drowned but not forgotten. Because if one city lies beneath the water, how many more rest under our feet? In 2022, divers exploring submerged caves in the Bahamas retrieved carved stones inscribed with symbols that didn't match Taino or Maya script. In Granada, a fisherman pulled up an obsidian pendant tangled in coral, shaped like an eye, lined in red pigment, dated thousands of years older than known island settlements. None of these finds made international headlines. But together they whisper, "We were here before your maps were drawn." So, was there an Atlantis in the Caribbean? Maybe not in the way Plato imagined, a golden utopia sunk in a single day. But perhaps in the truth colonizers feared most, that before conquest, before slavery, before sugar and salt and steel, the Caribbean was a place of innovation, spirit, and sovereignty, a world of sacred design, ruled not by kings, but by elders and memory. Maybe the sea didn't bury Atlantis. Maybe it guarded it, until we were ready to listen. In Chapter 5, we turn our attention to the Garifuna, the descendants of resistance, born from the union of runaway African slaves and the Kalinago, a people exiled from their islands, yet still carrying the soul of their homeland wherever they go. From the shores of St. Vincent to the coastlines of Belize and Honduras, the Garifuna carry songs of fire, drums of memory, and a language that defies erasure. The Garifuna Exodus, memory in motion. You can hear them before you see them. The drums, pulsing like heartbeats in exile. The chants, rising like smoke over the coast. And the language, Arawakan syllables kissed by African cadence, flowing like the ocean they were forced to cross. They are the Garifuna, a people born of collision, Kalinago resistance and African survival braided into one bloodline. Not quite islander, not quite mainlander, but something ancient and new all at once. They call themselves Garinagu, plural, communal, never alone. And their story is one of the most profound testaments to cultural memory in motion the Caribbean has ever known. The Garifuna did not begin as a people. They began as a refusal. Sometime in the early 1600s, a slave ship, some say Spanish, others say Portuguese, wrecked near the island of St. Vincent. Rather than drowning, a group of West Africans swam to shore and were taken in by the Kalinago. But this was not charity. This was alliance. The Kalinago saw not strangers, but kindred warriors. People brutalized by the same enemy. People who knew what it meant to run, to fight, to disappear into jungle and emerge stronger. And so, over decades, something unheard of happened. Two displaced worlds merged culturally, spiritually, linguistically, into a single identity forged in fire. The Garifuna became feared by the British and French alike. They built fortified villages in the mountains of St. Vincent, launched coastal raids on plantations, and ferried escaped slaves between islands. They were freedom's underground current, a nation with no king, no border, no flag, but unshakable unity. European powers labeled them Black Caribs, a term soaked in racism and fear. They claimed the Garifuna were more African than indigenous, to strip them of land rights. They used black, not as description, but as a justification for expulsion. The turning point came in the late 1700s. As the British tightened their grip on St. Vincent, the Garifuna, alongside Kalinago allies, launched the Second Carib War. They fought with everything they had, poisoned arrows, stone traps, guerrilla warfare, spiritual rituals. But they were outnumbered, outgunned. Chief Joseph Chadoir, the Garifuna war leader, was betrayed and killed in 1795. His death broke something, not the spirit of the Garifuna, but the hope that their island could remain free. And so came the exile. In 1797, the British rounded up over 5,000 Garifuna, chained them, and forced them onto ships. They were not sent to slavery, but to something worse, erasure without chains. The destination was the island of Roten, off the coast of Honduras. But many died in transit. Over half perished from disease, starvation, or suicide during the journey. Those who survived landed not as captives, but as ghosts of a stolen homeland. But ghosts too can rise. On Roten and the Central American coast, the Garifuna refused to disappear. They rebuilt, not just homes, but identity. They kept the language. They kept the drums. They kept the stories, whispered to children before bed, chanted to ancestors in sacred rituals. Their oral history stretches back centuries before colonization, retelling both Kalinago myths and African cosmology. They speak of Urumine, the ancestral homeland, St. Vincent, not as a memory, but as a living soul. Even today, Garifuna prayers begin with an invocation to those lost at sea. Because in Garifuna memory, the ocean is not a barrier. It's a vein, a sacred highway connecting them to the islands that birthed them. In Belize, Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua, the Garifuna built villages of resilience. They preserve their unique Afro-Indigenous language, which blends Arawakan roots with African intonation and French, Spanish, and English vocabulary. In 2001, UNESCO declared Garifuna language, dance, and music as a masterpiece of the oral and intangible heritage of humanity. But even that recognition cannot fully grasp the power of their story, because the Garifuna did not just survive. They carried a civilization, one that was meant to be erased, across an ocean and into a new future. Every November 19th in Belize, Garifuna Settlement Day is celebrated, not as a funeral for what was lost, but as a call to memory, a reenactment of the landing. Boats with drums, voices lifted in Ayo, the ancestral cry. It is not performance. It is ritual, a reminder, we are here. We are still here. We were never gone. Forgotten temples and the star architects of the islands. They built with no blueprints, no steel, no mortar, no machines, just stone and alignment with the stars. Long before Europeans arrived, long before the Spanish drew their maps and forced their crosses onto the land, something else had already been written into the Caribbean soil. Not in ink, but in geometry. Across the archipelago, from the windswept plains of Barbados to the misted peaks of St. Lucia, lay temples, petroglyphs, megalithic circles, and stone mounds, fragments of ancient design whose builders have no recorded names. But the stones speak, and the stars still remember. Our chapter begins in Guadeloupe, where beneath a sugar plantation, archaeologists discovered a complex ring of stones buried just beneath the topsoil. The formation was perfectly circular, and when the coordinates were run through astronomical software, the results were staggering. The central point aligned directly with Orion's belt, not just today, but as it would have appeared over 1,000 years ago. This wasn't coincidence. This was celestial knowledge encoded in rock. And it wasn't isolated. In Jamaica's Cockpit Country, nestled deep in the limestone valleys, there are boulders arranged in straight lines leading to now dry riverbeds. Oral tradition among the Maroons holds that these stones were guides of the moon, used to track seasons, harvest cycles, and spiritual ceremonies tied to lunar phases. The formations align almost precisely with the moon's 18.6-year metonic cycle, a complexity known only to the most advanced skywatchers of antiquity. Who were these people? How did they learn to track the heavens with such precision? And more importantly, why did they encode it into the land? Many scholars have tried to assign these structures to the Taino, and while the Taino did indeed possess sacred plazas and star knowledge, some sites predate Taino arrival by centuries, maybe more. In Barbados, recent radar scans beneath a colonial-era church revealed a stepped pyramid, buried under rubble and centuries of Christian architecture. Its core samples suggest a construction date that predates known settlement patterns by 600 to 800 years. In Dominica, a team of researchers led by an indigenous ethnobotanist uncovered a spiral-shaped complex of stones resembling a cosmic nebula when viewed from above. The locals called it the Path of the Breath. It was aligned not just to the stars, but to seasonal wind patterns. Spiritual design married to climate wisdom. Even the Caribbean's petroglyphs, etched into caves, river rocks, and seaside cliffs, hold secrets yet untranslated. They depict double spirals, triangles within circles, interlocking hands, and beings with elongated heads and star-shaped eyes. Some scholars dismiss them as decorative, but others see math, calendrical symbols, precession markers, astronomical charts. One of the most haunting carvings was found in St. Kitts, a circular figure surrounded by seven dots. When overlaid with modern astronomical software, the pattern matches the Pleiades star cluster. Coincidence? Or did these people know more than we've given them credit for? Across the Caribbean, European conquest intentionally desecrated sacred sites, converting temples into churches, ceremonial grounds into gallows, and burial mounds into cane fields. It wasn't just about domination. It was about rewriting the sky. By destroying these star maps, colonizers severed the Caribbean's connection to its own cosmic heritage. By stealing the land, they tried to erase the architecture of memory. But memory is resilient. Today, a new generation of indigenous Caribbean scholars, Maroon historians, and decolonial researchers are leading the charge to uncover these temples. Not as relics, but as blueprints of ancestral intelligence. Using LIDAR, ground-penetrating radar, and ancestral knowledge, they're mapping sacred alignments once thought lost forever. In St. Vincent, an excavation site recently uncovered an oblong stone chamber with acoustic properties that amplify human voice in specific frequencies. It's believed to have been a ritual sound chamber, used to invoke oracles or spirits of the mountain. In Puerto Rico, a circular plaza was found beneath a colonial estate. Its stones, when touched, emit a faint harmonic vibration, theorized to be part of an ancient healing resonance practice. This isn't fantasy. This is lost science, forgotten not because it failed, but because it was buried beneath conquest. We often think of the Caribbean as rich in music, food, and rebellion. But beneath it all is a cosmic blueprint, temples, star maps, and sonic geometries that once guided life, death, and destiny. They remind us that Caribbean civilizations were not only survivors. They were architects of time, designers of memory, builders of truth hidden in the stars. The cave keepers, death rituals, and the ancestral return. They did not bury the dead to forget them. They buried them to guide them home. In the Caribbean's ancient world, long before cathedrals were built, before coffins or crosses, death was not an ending. It was a migration, a transformation, a return to the source. And the source was the earth itself, its womb-like caves, its womb-like silence. Throughout the archipelago, from Puerto Rico's Rio Camuy caves to the limestone cathedrals of Dominica's interior, burial sites still hold human remains curled in fetal position, surrounded by shells, feathers, ceremonial blades, and stones carved with sacred faces. These were not corpses to be discarded. These were travelers, and the caves were passageways to the next world. The ancient Caribbean peoples, including the Taino, Kalinago, and their even older predecessors, believed that life began and ended in the caves. According to oral tradition, the first humans emerged from caves after a sacred serpent parted the earth. And so, when death arrived, the journey reversed. The dead returned to Mother Earth, Itabakawaba, who held them until their spirits could rise again, often reborn as birds, stars, or storms. Inside Cueva Clara, one of Puerto Rico's most sacred cave systems, archaeologists found petroglyphs of skeletal figures holding hands with spiral-eyed ancestors. Surrounding them were symbols of hurricanes, suggesting not chaos, but movement. Passage. Nearby, a narrow tunnel opens to a chamber known as the Voice Room, where even a whisper echoes for seconds. It's believed this was used in mourning rituals, where the voices of the living were amplified to reach the ears of the dead. In Haiti, near the village of Fonbridge, a cave known as Cay Centes, the home of the spirits, holds rows of skulls arranged in arcs, facing the cave's mouth, as if still watching the light, still waiting for a sign. These weren't macabre rituals. They were acts of devotion, of spiritual engineering. In the Bahamas, burial caves were discovered with bodies positioned beneath shafts of sunlight that enter only once a year, during solstices or equinoxes. The light falls directly onto the forehead or chest of the deceased. A solar key, perhaps, for the spirit's release. This was not random. It was ancestral architecture. Time, death, and nature, in divine harmony. But as with so much of Caribbean sacred life, colonialism shattered the cycle. The Spanish, in their hunger for gold and Christian dominion, raided burial caves, smashed skulls, and tore ceremonial objects from resting places to be shipped to Europe. Priests declared the rituals satanic. Caves were sealed, flooded, or converted into lime pits. To control the living, they had to silence the dead. But silence never lasts. Today, in the Dominican Republic, some families still leave offerings of rum and cassava at the mouths of sacred caves. In St. Lucia, elders still tell children not to speak loudly in certain grottos, not out of fear, but respect. And in Belize, where Garifuna memory fuses Kalinago and African belief, the sea is still spoken of as the path back to the dead, and drums as the bridge to call them home. These are not superstitions. They are resistance rituals, acts of defiance against erasure. Modern science is finally catching up. Advanced scans of Caribbean caves now reveal burial chambers older than previously thought, with layers of offerings suggesting intergenerational use. families returning to the same cave over centuries. DNA from bone fragments confirms deep continuity. People remain tied to specific sites for hundreds of years, returning again and again to lay their loved ones to rest beside ancestors. Not because they feared death, but because they understood it. In 2023, a research team in Guadeloupe discovered an undisturbed cave filled with stone urns, each one holding ashes, beads, and shards of obsidian knives. At the center, a carved stone spiral with a hole in its middle, a cosmic doorway, perhaps for the soul to pass through. The Caribbean dead were not buried to decay. They were buried to transform, into wind, into rain, into story. In the end, the cave is not a tomb. It's a library, a place where stone remembers what paper forgot. And if you sit quietly long enough, deep in the dark, away from cell towers and noise, you may hear something. A drumbeat beneath the soil. A whisper in a tongue your bones somehow understand. A voice that says, "We are not gone. We are still here. We are the roots beneath your future."